on Wednesday, June 11th. This is Studio 2. I'm Cherry Gregg.
And my name is Avi Wolfman-Arendt. Welcome to our house here, Studio 2 at WHYY. The topic of the show today is housing. Is it not, Cherry?
It is, because Philadelphia is on the brink of a $2 billion housing overhaul as Philadelphia City Council gears up to approve Mayor Sherrell Parker's Housing Opportunities Made Easy or Home Plan. She aims to create or preserve 30,000 housing units. The mayor says Philly's housing crisis is real and it's personal for many Philadelphians. We've seen skyrocketing rents. We've seen increased house costs when you want to buy a house, and it's out of reach for many Philadelphians. And so she says housing is her top priority. But the mayor wants to borrow about $800 million in bonds, and it has sparked debate on whether it's a bold move, a reckless move, or both. And so today we're going to talk about it.
I guess it could be both, right? Yeah. You can be bold and reckless
at the same time.
I guess you can.
And so we'll dig into what's being promised, who stands to benefit, who could be left behind, and what cities nationwide could teach the city of Philadelphia. So the question of the day is this: what can the city do to lower housing costs? Is this $800 million bond the best investment for the city? We have a lot of crises, right? Is this the best use of the funds? You can call 888-477-9499. You can email studio2@whyy.org, or you can comment in live chat on YouTube or Facebook if you're watching there.
We just got some interesting data today from Pew. They polled Philadelphians, and they found, and we could talk about the larger findings maybe tomorrow, but one of the things they found is that Sherrell Parker has a 63%. Wow. Approval rating, one of the highest they've ever measured, and they've been doing this poll since 2009. So she's got some political capital. Mm-hmm. Now she's cashing it in on this big play for affordable housing, lowering housing costs in Philadelphia. And of course, everyone wants to know, will it work? I'm very excited to dive in this hour.
Yep.
Speaking of politics, trio of local news stories coming your way, starting with politics across the bridge in Jersey. The votes are in for New Jersey's primary held yesterday, and the results are about what we expected. In the Republican race for governor, Jack Cittarelli cruised to his second consecutive primary win, racking up more than two-thirds of the vote. Last time he ran for this same seat in this same primary, he also won, but he got only half of the GOP vote in the last Republican primary. So two-thirds this time, a very strong showing for Cittarelli. On the Democratic side, it was more competitive. It was a bigger field. Six people ran, but still, it was not very close. North Jersey Congresswoman Mikey Sherrill emerged victorious. She got 34% of the vote, or at least of what's counted so far. Second place went to Newark Mayor Roz Baraka, who got about 20%, so a pretty big gap there. Mm-hmm. The big takeaway, it's going to be Cittarelli versus Mikey Sherrill in November for the top seat in New Jersey.
Yeah, and Cittarelli got really close when he took on Murphy in the last gubernatorial election. So he has the Trump endorsement.
And a lot of name recognition.
A lot of name recognition. So Mikey Sherrill has to do some work traveling throughout the state. But I looked at the map, and she had support throughout Jersey, Central Jersey, South Jersey. So she's known. And like you said, Avi, all of our folks who came on last week, They said they thought she would win, and she did.
Yeah, but shout out to the polls, I guess.
I guess so.
Because
they're right.
We do give polls a hard time for not being able to determine who's going to win a very close race. And pollsters will tell you, these instruments are not the most fine-tuned instruments, talking about polls. But in terms of getting a general sense in like a really crazy divided field like this of who seems to have the path and who doesn't, they're actually pretty good.
Yeah.
And this is a case of that. I'll also note that it's not just important to focus on who wins in a six-person race, but also the order below that. Roz Baraka, 20%, a pretty strong showing for the New York mayor.
Progressives, those are the progressives, yeah.
Steve Sweeney finished last, South Jersey Steve Sweeney, and it's been a sort of a steep fall for him ever since he lost his state Senate seat to Ed Durr. And this would suggest that he just does not have a lot of juice in state races moving forward. So again, the order still matters when you're looking at the future. But Mikey Sherrill, the clear victor yesterday among the Dems.
Yes. And so moving on to our second story in the trio, of local news stories. Philadelphia protests against ICE on Tuesday resulted in two police officers suffering minor injuries, 15 people arrested, and two protesters suffering injuries. All of this stemmed from an emergency action protest that began around 4 o'clock p.m. on Tuesday outside of the Federal Detention Center. About 50 people showed up near 7th and Arch following rumors of multiple arrests being made by ICE. These were just rumors. At some point, that group grew to be about 150 demonstrators, and then they started marching to ICE offices near 8th and Cherry, disrupting traffic. An Inquirer video from the Center City protest shows that things kind of escalated during a confrontation between police and a masked man. And on the video, you can see a police officer holding the man down with his knee and things sort of, you know, in an attempt to handcuff this man. There's other video that shows three officers trying to pull another protester down to the ground to arrest them. And one of the officers used a baton to hit the protester in their legs. And police say they issued orders to disperse, but things sort of escalated from there. PPD says one of their vehicles was also vandalized. And all of this, of course, comes as tensions escalate between the Trump administration and protesters in Los Angeles over ICE raids there. And there's been these solidarity protests. Currently, California has sued the Trump administration, saying the deployment of, you know, National Guard troops to Los Angeles is an overreach of presidential authority and unconstitutional. And there's going to be more protests this weekend, obviously.
Yeah, we're all keeping an eye on that. June 14th, those No Kings protests happening all across the country, but a big one, really the central one, happening here in Philadelphia. And well, looking at the video that you talked about from yesterday, that was the closest I had seen to, you know, anything that looked like 2020 here in Philadelphia over the last 5 years. Doesn't mean that's the path we're headed down, but obviously all of us who lived through that looked at that scene, the way the police were behaving, the confrontation with the protesters, and said that does conjure a familiar feeling. And because it comes on the eve of these long scheduled, larger protests that are going to be happening this weekend, obviously there is an edginess in the air, and we're all going to be watching and monitoring.
Yeah, and people are very sensitive now, especially when it comes to ICE and ICE arrests. So we'll be watching. Yeah. Third story.
Shifting now to the third story. You know, they say, Cherry, you're sipping some water there. Is that a cue?
I'm sipping it out of a cup.
Well, they say that Jesus turned water into wine.
Oh,
so
yes, he did.
What type of person turns wine into water?
A sommelier.
There you go. The New York Times had a piece this week on the rise of, and I'm not making this up, fine water. This is very natural water harvested from around the world, often sold at a very high price. It is marketed and enjoyed much like fine wine. Each water has a specific flavor or terroir related to its original source.
Yes.
Example. Oh, you're laughing?
No, no.
You think this is a joke?
No, it's not. It was in the New York Times. It's real. Go ahead.
Examples of fine water include melted snow filtered through Peruvian volcanic rock.
Sounds refreshing.
And water harvested from nets hung in a Tasmanian pine forest. Fine water. It's
water.
A trend. It is a
water. You got to roll those R's at the end of that. Go ahead.
Why are we rolling our R's?
I don't know. It just sounds like you
fancy.
Should do something. You got to make it fancier.
Got it. All right. So, of course, I had to ask you, Cherry, what would be your fine water product harvested from the lush and wondrous Delaware Valley?
It just doesn't seem like lush and wondrous the Delaware Valley. So, and this is kind of funny joke, but I was thinking, how about the Schuylkill Reserve?
Tell me about the Schuylkill Reserve.
So we can, because the top of the Schuylkill, gunk. So we're going to dig right down to the bottom.
Okay.
And we're going to tap the bottom of the Schuylkill.
Okay.
And we're going to filter it through rocks taken from the banks of the Wissahickon Creek.
Ooh. And what does it taste like?
Probably has a bit of a earthy taste.
Nice.
Maybe a little metallic. Probably some hints of brake dust from all the traffic along the The Schuylkill Expressway. And I feel like we could pair it with hoagies, you know, other Philadelphia foods, maybe a salty pretzel.
I like that pairing. All right. So let me present mine to you. I present to you Eau de Garbage.
Oh, my gosh.
Harvested from a dumpster pool on the 2300 block of Tulip Street.
Ooh.
This luxury libation has strong notes of metal and rubber. Ah.
Oh, rubber.
But what's lurking in the back of the bouquet? Yes. It's a hint of twisted tea, accented with the faintest outline of expired sunscreen. Eau de Garbage. Why drink water when you can drink water?
Water. Oh, that's so good. By the way, I can just taste it in the back of my mouth. You know how stuff gets stuck, like, right there.
A little Eau de Garbage. Yes. Well, here's a big question for us.
From the back of a dumpster.
Okay. Is this new housing plan from the city of Philadelphia garbage, or is it gold? We're going to explore in the next segment talking about this big, bold new housing initiative from the Parker administration. Yep. We want to hear from you. Studio2@whyy.org or give us a call, 888-477-9499. We'll be right back on WHYY's Studio 2. Welcome back to Studio 2 on WHYY. I'm Avi Wolfman-Arendt.
And I'm Cherry Gregg. Barring a major surprise, Mayor Sherrell Parker's signature housing initiative will pass City Council tomorrow. It's a sprawling plan that steers money to dozens of programs. And to pay for it, Philadelphia will take out $800 million worth of bonds.
Some say that's too much. Others say not enough. What most agree on is that Philadelphia has an affordable housing problem. Today, we'll talk about how the city plans to fix that problem and how that plan compares to approaches in other cities.
But starting local, we're going to do that with Aaron Moselle, who covers housing and community development for WHYY's Plan Philly. Aaron, welcome back to Studio 2.
Thanks for having me.
And on Zoom, we have Rue Landau, city council member at large, a former housing lawyer and vice chair of the Philadelphia City Council Housing Committee. Council member Landau, welcome to Studio 2.
Thank you so much for having me.
It's great to have you here, and it's great to have our listeners with us. We have a couple questions for you this hour. What can the city do to lower housing costs? And is this $800 million bond the best investment for the city? Or perhaps should the city spend it on addressing other issues? Give us a call, 888-477-9499. You can email studio2@whyy.org. If you're on YouTube or Facebook, leave a comment right there in the chat.
And so, you know, Aaron, we wanted to start with you because we want you to sort of lay out the issue with housing, because we talked about, you know, Philly's, you know, housing stock is aging, rents are climbing, vacancies abound. So give us a lay of the land. How big is the housing problem here in the city?
Yes. Yeah, so like many places around the country, Philadelphia has a housing deficit. The figure that the Parker administration has brought up repeatedly during this process is that we're 17,000 units short. And there's a great need for housing at the lowest end of the spectrum for folks who are what are known as cost burden, which means they spend more than at least 30% of their income on rent. And so that has been a part of this discussion about, you know, we need to help those folks, but there's also plenty of folks who make more than that who are also struggling to make ends meet and pay for a mortgage or pay for their rent.
Susan comments, does the mayor's proposal include monies to present to help owners repair their properties? I think that's what Susan's saying. Mm-hmm. Seems to me folks would like to stay in their homes but can't afford repairs. So let's talk about what's in this plan. It is a little hard to summarize because there's so many things. Could you pick a couple of things in this plan that really stand out, either because we're investing a lot of money in them through this plan or just because maybe they're unusual in some other way?
Yeah, I mean, the top line for this plan is that it's rooted in a campaign promise to create or preserve 30,000 units of housing. That's not just affordable housing, but across the spectrum. But the administration is focusing mostly on low to moderate income housing. PHA, the Philadelphia Housing Authority, has its own separate plan for revamping its portfolio, and that's for sort of the lowest for folks who need the most help to cover rent. And then it has been said in the past that the private market is sort of handling the market rate end of this thing. To answer your question more directly, you know, so there are programs, yes, for housing preservation, for a sort of free home repairs. There's a very popular program known as the Basic Systems Repair Program that you know, helps folks who can't afford to make needed repairs to their properties. But there's also a whole host of programs that provide rental assistance and programs designed to prevent homelessness and programs to remove blight. So there's just a wide range here. It's all about both building homes, keeping people in homes that they want to stay in, and also helping people cover their mortgage, cover their rent.
Yeah, I want to bring Councilmember Rue Landau into the conversation. Councilmember Landau, you're vice chair of the Philadelphia City Council Housing Committee. You support the plan. You've issued a statement about this. So tell me why you threw your support behind it.
So I think we're at this pivotal moment in Philadelphia. Aaron really just outlined the stats so perfectly. We've got a crisis here in Philly. We've got an affordable housing crisis here in Philly. And we're at this moment where we can have this transformational shift. $800 million invested in mostly affordable housing. You know, we can funnel a lot of this to the places where we need it most. In Philadelphia, we have, you know, we have a problem that people's wages have not kept up with the cost of rent or buying a house or even staying in their house. So you've got 50% of renters and one third of renters and 16% of homeowners who are paying more than 50% of their income in rent. It's just unaffordable. And the array of programs that we have in Philadelphia and the expansion of these programs are really just going to help out and really just give people what they need, which is, you know, it could be, we talked about repairing their home to stay in their home, right? When you've got a leak that's coming from your roof through your bedroom down to your kitchen, it is very difficult to make your decisions. You're going to work, you're distracted. You have to decide whether also to pay for school supplies, maybe to pay for medicine or to fix the leak. Let's just help that family fix the leak and have them go on with their lives and take care of all the rest of their business.
Now, not everyone on council was gung-ho about this plan. Let me play this clip from Councilmember Isaiah Thomas, who says there are other priorities the city fails to address with the same financial dedication. Here is a clip of him during last week's Finance Committee hearing. This is Isaiah Thomas.
There's an education crisis in the city of Philadelphia as well. You all used that and talked about it a little bit earlier. There's a poverty crisis in the city of Philadelphia as well. I just looked at Councilmember Young. He talks all of time about the fact that there's a gun violence crisis in the city of Philadelphia as well. I'm sure someone else will talk about a septic crisis and so many other crises that exist in the city of Philadelphia. I don't see us pouring $1 billion into those crises. So since we're pouring $1 billion into this particular crisis, that's what you're proposing, you're going to see a certain level of scrutiny because there is a lot of us who on a consistent basis hear from constituents who talk about a lot of other things that's not just housing.
So Councilmember Landau, let me cue you up now. Why this investment in housing as opposed to other major issues? And if you were mayor, is this where you would have steered the ship?
Well, let's start with, yes, this was a goal and a passion of the mayor. So this is her initiative. But I was very quickly to get behind it, along with Councilmember Gaudier, who's the chair of the Housing Committee, to do the $800 million. Councilmember Thomas is not wrong. We have many crises in the city of Philadelphia and many, many, many challenges. But from my experience, both as a housing lawyer at a legal aid organization, as well as running the city's Fair Housing Commission, housing creates the stability that can affect so many other parts of your life. And when we tackle this part, and when we take care of this, I'm really hoping that trickles through to take care of so many of the other issues in the city. We know every couple of years, there's a study that comes out that talks about how neighborhood violence will reduce when we take care of our housing and our blocks, right? You get rid of blight, get rid of abandoned cars, do the curb appeal. The violence in a neighborhood, based on study after study, goes down from 13 to 30% at that point. This is quite probable that taking the gamble on this investment will actually trickle out and affect so many of these other issues. And also, just to keep in mind, the way that this funding is being passed is that the council is going to have tremendous oversight over how this money is spent. So the mayor will, the mayor's office will have to come to us every quarter and also annually to show us how they're spending the money and what they propose to spend the money on. And we get to weigh in and make it more of a collective effort.
Quick follow-up to you, Rue Landau, is, you know, there's a lot of precariousness right now with the Trump administration, you know, threatening funding, federal funding cuts to cities like Philadelphia. Are there any concerns? Because this proposal, right, or the bill that will likely be voted on tomorrow, talks about this $800 million up front. And there's going to be hundreds of millions of more that are going to be paid by the city in interest on this borrowing. Your thoughts on that, given just the uncertainty? Is there, should the city council have sort of considered taking out smaller chunks just in case, because we don't know what's going to happen?
Well, as I said, council's going to have the oversight that at some point, if the proposers are coming to us that don't direct the money in the places and the ways in which we need, we will not have the funding go forward. But most importantly, I actually think this is, you know, nothing that's going to happen under the Trump administration is going to be good timing for any big city in America. There, we are the poorest large city in America, and we want to change that distinction, right? So this investment now feels to me like Philly taking care of Philly. We don't need to worry about the feds on this level. We have affordable housing complexes right now that will time out of their subsidies, right? Most of these big buildings that are subsidized get into contracts with the federal government for 20 or 30 years. A lot of those are coming up for expiration. This amount of money allows Philadelphia to jump in and fill the gap and to keep it affordable so that the maybe 100 people who live in this unit aren't homeless and can't afford other places to live. Again, I can't underscore this enough. This is Philly taking care of Philly for one of the most important sanctity places that we have, which is what we call home. So whether you're a renter, yeah, and now we in Philly have more renters than we do homeowners, or if you're a homeowner, and we have so many low-income homeowners in Philly who just can't afford to maintain the place they live, which we know is mm-hmm. always the most cost-effective, and what people want is to rehab and take care of the place they already live. This is the investment that we need to take care of that.
Before we let you go, I want to ask about one more thing. some developers say it's just too hard to build in the city of Philadelphia, and one of the problems they point to is the fact that a district council members can often stop a project through a tradition called councilmanic prerogative. Do you think that's something the council needs to address and perhaps eliminate in the future?
I definitely think that we need to be taking a much harder look at this now, particularly because Philly has changed so much. You know, most people are not born in one neighborhood, stay in that neighborhood, live in that neighborhood anymore. Just the same as, you know, people take trips around the state and the country and to other parts of the world, we live and move around Philadelphia much more freely now. And because of that, it's kind of a global city. And one Philadelphia really means that you can move and live anywhere. And I think we need to have more people looking at the decisions that are being made in every single neighborhood.
Yeah. And Aaron, we wanted to, you know, as we close out the segment, I mean, there's a lot of politics being done right now. And it looks like council is going to approve this. This is Mayor Parker's top priority. This is a pretty big gamble on her part politically. Your thoughts on that, just given the, you know, just some of the, just given the political sort of makeup of council and some of the pushback that she's been seeing?
Yeah, I mean, this is certainly her biggest policy agenda item, and the biggest thing that we're going to, we've seen to date out of this administration in terms of policy. Obviously, there was the Sixers arena situation that took up a lot of time, and people have a lot of feelings about that and how that turned out. Just to bounce off what the councilwoman was saying in terms of you know, control, you know, within the amendments to the funding bill, council has agreed or will agree, it's expected that they will agree, to give up some of that councilmatic prerogative when it comes to how certain parcels are disposed of.
The a small concession.
Administration.
But it's, the issue is
it's a
live.
Fairly major concession. Historically,
historically, right.
You know, this is all meant to sort of fast track parcels in the city's inventory so that they can be repurposed and reused for affordable housing. Some of that conversation is happening.
Yes. And there's also other efforts to clear some of the red tape and deal with some of the speed bumps that many developers complain about.
Right, the less sexy parts of this, but really, you know, there's a lot of bureaucracy when it comes to getting something built in Philadelphia, and the administration has said it is very committed to streamlining that process.
Well, thanks for clearing some time and talking with us today, Aaron. Hopefully, sure. At least streamlined your appearance onto this show. Aaron Mozell, who covers housing and community development for WHYY's Plan Philly, appreciate your time.
You got it.
And same to you, Rue Landau, vice chair of the Philadelphia City Council Housing Committee and a former housing lawyer. Councilmember Landau, thanks for the time on Studio 2.
Thank you so much for having me.
And so coming up next, we'll be talking about what Philadelphia can learn from cities across the country who are also dealing with affordable housing issues.
Yeah, we're going to broaden the conversation on the other side of this break, bring in an expert, Vincent Reyna. Very excited and interested to hear his perspective. Of course, we want to hear yours as well. What can the city do to lower housing costs? Is this $800 million bond the best investment for the city? Give us a call, 888-477-9499.
Planet Money helps you understand the economy. We find the people at the center of the story.
Garbage in New York, that was like a controlled substance.
We show you how money influences everything.
Tell me what you like by telling me how you spend your money.
And we dig until we get answers.
I had a bad feeling you're going to bring that up.
Planet Money finds out. All you have to do is listen. The Planet Money podcast from NPR.
And welcome back, everybody, to WHYY's Studio 2. I'm Avi Wolfman-Arendt.
And I'm Cherry Gregg. And we've discussed Philadelphia's Home Initiative with Councilmember Rue Landau and WHYY's Plan Philly reporter Aaron Mozell earlier. And we want to now broaden the conversation to talk about initiatives around the country that help lower costs for renters and home buyers.
Joining us to help us do that is Vincent Reyna, a professor and the faculty director of the Housing Initiative at the University of Pennsylvania. He also served as senior policy advisor on housing and urban policy in the White House Domestic Policy Council from 2022 to 2024. Vincent Reyna, welcome to Studio 2.
Thank you for having me.
And our question for you, our fine listener, what can the city do to lower housing costs? And is this $800 million bond the best investment for the city? Give us a call, 888-477-9499. Email studio2@whyy.org. If you're on YouTube or Facebook, drop a comment in the chat.
And so, Vincent, we wanted to first start with you by getting your thoughts on the home initiative here that's likely going to be approved tomorrow in Philadelphia City Council. And I specifically want to talk about, because you did some work, a study on the housing needs in Philadelphia, and your study seems to show that we need a lot more than 30,000 units of housing. Your thoughts?
Yeah, no, I mean, our study showed that we essentially need over 64,000 units of affordable housing units for the lowest income households in Philadelphia. So we look at kind of different income bands. The lowest income band is people who make 30% of what we call the area median income, which is the median income for the whole area. And you find that there's a dramatic shortage of housing units available at all for those households. And what that does is it puts pressure across the whole housing market, right? Because there are no affordable and available units for those households, they start consuming more expensive units. So now they're housing cost burden, but they're also taking a unit that would have been affordable to someone at a higher income band, which is then pushing them up as well. So interestingly enough, there's kind of like a pressure coming from the bottom, right? Due to that lack of affordable units in the city of Philadelphia, which really creates the need to be bold and ambitious on the housing front. So it's really exciting to kind of see the mayor really leaning into housing as one of her priority areas.
What are the root causes of this affordable housing crisis here in Philadelphia and across the country? Because we heard from a prior guest that wages are not growing as fast as housing costs. Something's making that happen. So what, to you, Vincent Reyna, are like cause maybe one, two, and three?
Yeah. So, I mean, the biggest cause is that we underproduced housing for way too long, right? Mm-hmm. After the 2008 recession, you see a dramatic drop in the number of housing units that were being completed across the whole country. And that's particularly true in a place like Philadelphia. And so what that does is it causes people to essentially bid up rents, right? If there's fewer units coming online, there's more people competing for units and prices start going up. So in cities like Philadelphia, where traditionally there were a lot of more affordable housing units and even home ownership opportunities, more people are bidding for those units, right? At the same time, as you know, we live in a very old city. And so we also have housing quality issues in this housing stock. And so you actually have units that are kind of need a lot of repairs. And because those repair needs are not being met, you could actually see them leaving the housing stock. So you have this kind of two dynamics going on at the same time that we're seeing across the whole country, and particularly in a city like Philadelphia, which is both the housing supply story, but also a housing quality story, which is what makes Philadelphia particularly unique.
That's interesting. Interesting. So it's like basically you're not building enough, but also some of the stuff that's out there that already exists gets so old and dilapidated that people can't live in it anymore.
That's exactly right. To the point that our study actually showed that even if you gave all the poorest households in Philadelphia enough income to move them up to the next income band, there still actually wouldn't be enough affordable housing units for those folks, right? Mm-hmm. So the wage story is real, but there's actually a fundamental housing supply story that even if we address wages, still would lead to dramatic housing affordability challenges in the city of Philadelphia.
And that this, you know, goes to, you know, a question of what have we learned and what could we learn from other cities? I mean, because some have said that, you know, buying housing, like some of this old, you know, more abandoned properties that need major repairs is actually cheaper if you rehab them than building new housing. Your thoughts and what you've learned from across the country.
Yeah, and this came up in the prior conversation as well, right? The idea of just making it easier to build is so important. And we've seen a bunch of cities around the country really make inroads on that front, right? So Minneapolis and their 2040 plan, Austin, Texas, made multiple strides to make it easier and reduce the regulations around building that essentially drive up price, increase time, do all those kinds of things. And you're already actually seeing impacts on their housing market where you're seeing actually rents decrease in areas where there's still actually a lot of demand, right? And we've seen some signs of Philadelphia doing that already, right? So Councilwoman Gaudier actually just passed one of her kind of signature legislations just passed, which was actually kind of streamlining the process around bringing affordable housing developments online, right? So the idea of actually leaning into the fact that process is important and can both block buildings from being built, but also make it more expensive because it takes more time, is actually a really important reality to address head on. And a lot of places are really making strides there. In Los Angeles, they found a dramatic kind of impact of regulation relief they created around transit-oriented developments, right? So they made it easier to build around train stations in LA, and research has showed that actually had a huge impact on driving down costs and actually contributing to the number of units that are actually being built by transit in LA.
Hmm. Let me bring in a caller now. This is Ebon from Pineland National Reserve. Ebon, you're on Studio 2. What's your question or comment?
Hi, can you hear me?
Yep, you're on the show.
Okay, yes. So the elephant in the room, to my mind, is that we used to have a strong middle class and a stronger working class that had enough coins in the pocket to build houses of their own. But all the money has shot up the pyramid to the billionaires to the millionaires to the private equity companies that buy up lots of houses and then raise prices. So every major problem we've had, whether it's inflation or the cost of food or the cost of housing, is due to this elephant in the room, and we need to address it. I also want to point out that the water in the Pinelands is delicious.
Nice.
We're sitting on top of an aquifer.
All right. You'll send me your pitch for that Pinelands water. But Ebon brings up an important point because I hear this all the time. Mm-hmm. There is a theory of this problem that goes more or less that private equity or sort of, you know, otherwise predatory actors in this space are buying up property, raising rents, maybe sitting on property that could be rented out to people. I'm not so sure about the idea of people building their own houses. Mm-hmm. I would imagine you have to go back many, many decades to find people literally building their own houses. But that second point about private equity, could you address that, Vincent Reyna? Is that a big,
piece of the puzzle? You know, the reality in a city like Philadelphia that has been disinvested in for quite some time, that there's a balance of trying to bring in investment, but also the correct investment that actually benefits local residents, increases the housing supply and affordability and all those kinds of things. And the reality is there is investor activity that goes on in Philadelphia, much like other cities. But that investor activity represents some real market failures that exist that in many ways the housing plan in Philadelphia hopefully will address, right? The idea that small landlords often have a hard time accessing financing to actually invest in their properties. Nonprofits who are mission-driven have a hard time actually accessing the financing to acquire those properties, right? And across the country, we've seen a bunch of places kind of dabble with programs to try to meet this gap and actually create a more competitive market. Again, the idea here, right, is that we want to have investment, but we don't want to have an advantage going towards kind of profit-seeking firms who can kind of extract the fact that they have resources and other folks don't, and by doing that, charge higher prices, right? That's when it's fundamentally a problem. And so in the city of Philadelphia, actually, they created some small land, the Rental Improvement Fund, which actually is kind of a loan program for small landlords in Philadelphia to help them repair their homes and their properties and actually maintain them in the housing stock and maintain their homeownership. Programs like that are really important, right? Because we can't just say investors are bad, right? What we have to do is acknowledge the kind of market failures that they're responding to and actually create programs and opportunities for those failures to be addressed and for our housing stock to actually grow and be invested in.
Yeah. And by the way, Gloria comments, Jumpstart Germantown has been doing amazing work in creating affordable housing by rehabbing, mainly in Germantown, but expanding. They actually train individuals who live in communities to become small time developers. And then they build housing units that they can rent out as small landlords. By the way, if you want to join the conversation, our question of the day is, what can the city do to lower housing costs? Is this $800 million bond the best investment for the city? The number is 888-477-9499. You can also email studio2 at whyy.org. We're going to bring in another caller. We have Mary from Center City on the line. Mary, you're on Studio 2. What's your question or comment?
Hi, I went to that talk that you had about the Jumpstart, and it was excellent, and it's such a great program. And those are the people that this city should be supporting. And instead of giving big, huge real estate developers that are building these high rises with $2, $3, $4, and $5 million apartments that are going to get 10-year tax abatements, the city has held on to that 10-year tax abatement way too long. The way that people should be phased out of it, and they shouldn't be able to take advantage of it more than once. And the real estate developers shouldn't be getting tax breaks at that level. The tax breaks should be given to homeowners that want to fix their houses up. They should be given to other people, not to big real estate developers. And they should be fining real estate developers that are sitting on blighted buildings around this city.
So thanks so much, Mary.
Hedge fund guys and all that stuff. Thank you.
All right. So Mary has some issues with a prior policy, the tax abatement. I guess this still is driving back to the conversation that we were having, Vincent Reyna, which is, how do you spur investment without creating loopholes for people to take advantage of? Because you know, any program you imagine that you dream up is going to create an advantage for someone and a disadvantage for someone else. And there are often ways to, you know, work a program to your advantage. That could result in a good thing, but it can also result in some bad things. How do you actually kind of, I don't know, con-proof essentially a government program to spur investment in housing?
Look, I mean, that's a perennial challenge, right? And in many ways, one, we have to always kind of look at what is the ultimate outcome we're trying to get to, and have we actually gotten there, right? And the acknowledgement that we live in a world of public-private partnerships, and by virtue of that, you have a scenario where, you know, private actors are going to want some form of profit, right? So there's a legitimate question here of, you know, what is the correct level of profit and to whom? You know, hearkening back to a little bit of what was coming up here, though, is this idea of really kind of building the capacity of local organizations to engage in this work. And so in Chicago, there's a great organization called the Chicago Community Loan Fund. In New York, there's the Community Preservation Corporation. These are actually community development financial institutions that do a lot of lending for affordable housing, but they also do a lot of technical assistance and capacity building for organizations to actually engage in this work. And so the reality is, too, is, you know, we need to kind of think about how to build up that capacity and kind of support that capacity. So you have folks who are coming in with the kind of long view in mind, thinking about benefits to the community, thinking about benefits to the city, thinking about issues of affordability and showing real commitment to that, actually being to be able to like in the game, right? So part of this is, you know, creating programs that work well, but also ensuring that there's a lot of folks on the ground who could actually use these programs in the way that we actually intend them to. I guess the last thing I would just say there is like, policymaking is an ongoing thing, right? Just because a program has an issue doesn't mean the program's a failure. It means that we have to address that issue, right? So acknowledging that a program can be good, and then we could see ways that it has to be better. Markets react to programs, so programs have to evolve. So it's all to say that I think there's a lot of kind of responsive policymaking, actually, that we saw during the pandemic, interestingly, that needs to translate to real time now, which is presents a real opportunity as we think of like housing plans and priorities in that way of kind of prioritizing the policymaking process and evolution to make sure that we're constantly making programs that work.
Yeah, I want to read a couple comments. Joanne says, I'm seeing more and more short-term rentals, Airbnb encroaching on our neighborhoods, further reducing our housing supply. We need regulation around allowable density of short-term rentals in our city. And Katie says, define affordable housing. She says, rent control, subsidies, addressing homelessness. And so this brings me to the next question, which is sort of one of the critiques of this housing plan has been sort of that it's not necessarily going to, I guess one of the critiques is what is affordable housing, right? That the plan sort of stays, you know, around 120%, I guess, poverty line. I want you to sort of look at that issue. How do you sort of, as a government entity, make sure that the people at the very bottom have access to housing when you said that if we provide more housing for it at that level, that it'll sort of clear up the logjam?
Yeah, no, and that's exactly right. I think that the numbers show that in Philadelphia, the real demands for the lowest income households, and we use the term affordable housing to mean everything in many ways, right? Because we all want some form of affordable housing. It's all relative to us. So when we think about kind of how to define it, you're often defining it based on what population you're trying to serve. The reality is that it's really challenging to provide affordable housing opportunities for those with the lowest incomes, right? Because they have the least money to pay rent because they have less income by definition, right? And so in acknowledging that, what it presents is a real kind of opportunity, particularly in places like Philadelphia, where there still are some relatively affordable housing units, to ensure that we preserve the affordability of those existing affordable units, invest in them so they're quality places to live. And you've seen that in a lot of like our home repair programs. City of Philadelphia actually historically has had a large share of low-income homeowners, right? Things like the Basic Systems Repair Program, things like Rebuilding Together, right? These are all kind of programs that are made to invest in low-income homeowners homeowners to allow them to maintain their homeownership, but also maintain that their asset and access to affordable housing. So all to say is that here, I think you're hitting on one clear important reality, which is we have to be clear about what we're talking about with affordable housing and who we're actually serving. And, you know, serving those with the lowest incomes is a real need in Philadelphia. And there's a host of programs that are aiming to do that already, and a real opportunity to kind of leverage the fact that there are units that are affordable right now in the city and we could keep them affordable and improve their quality. But also we can expand that stock by leveraging resources. PHA just put out an ambitious plan to increase the number of affordable units in their portfolio. And we're seeing this actually in housing authorities across the country. Montgomery County has been at the forefront of creating a loan product that creates more mixed income housing and expands affordable housing supply. And so we're really venturing whole new areas where there are a lot of potential opportunities. And we're going to see in the years to come how those actually get realized.
Stephen from Chestnut Hill says the only thing that would help is bring down property taxes. Mm-hmm. City council is corrupt. We can't trust them with almost $1 billion. Okay. Mm-hmm. Stephen's got some takes. But let me ask you, Vincent, because there's so many different programs doing so many different things in so many different major American cities. And yet you look city to city, and oftentimes the big picture looks pretty similar, that housing costs are going up way too fast compared to what people make, which suggests to me that there just is an outer limit to what government, especially local government, can reasonably do. Am I right? Like, how much of this can local government, you know, really solve? And what accounts for the parts that they can't solve? Like, what needs to happen to move the rest of that needle?
Look, as you said in my introduction, I just came from a stint at the White House, and I think there's a clear federal policy role here, yeah. Right? In the Biden-Harris administration, we launched the first ever Housing Supply Action Plan, Blueprint for Renters Bill of Rights. We launched a whole bunch of initiatives that started really kind of hitting the ground in really important ways. The reality is we have no housing safety net. For every one household who receives a Section 8 voucher, there are another four who are eligible and do not receive it, right? And that's a fundamental problem. That said, there's a lot states and localities can do. And in many ways, like your prompt for the viewers is indicative of one of the key challenges, right? Is that in under-resourced environments, we're often kind of debating across different policy options, right? And we often wait for a crisis scenario to essentially create the impetus to really go full force into a addressing an issue. So in many ways, what we're seeing is like a real ambitious policy response to a housing affordability crisis that was kind of a decade in the making, right? And you could easily argue, though, our ability to respond this robustly is only because it's a crisis, right?
Yeah, that's fair.
And so there's a lot we can do to learn in this moment, to actually correct systems at the federal level and the local level, so we don't get ourselves in the scenario going forward. But there's a lot we also need to do in the immediate term to really kind of help people, because a lot of folks are really kind of on the brink of eviction, on losing their homes, and all those other kind of realities that we want to make sure don't actually happen.
And we're going to try to squeeze in one more caller before the show ends. We have Gary from Germantown on the line. Gary, you're on Studio 2. If you could keep it brief, what's your question or comment?
Okay, well, first, I just want to thank the main expert there. He's fantastic. So two things. Number one is that we can really cut down the cost of housing through prefab, the main problem of the building trades union. So why not have a public partnership between the city and the building trades union, so that they together own a prefab housing company?
Interesting.
So I wanted to get his advice. And then the second thing is that Get Courage Now has developed very free, simple technology that enables huge rent strikes against the big owners that own hundreds of units, because it makes it much easier for thousands of people to agree to go on a rent strike, because they can simply say, well, I'll go on the rent strike if 9,999 others will join me.
Well, thanks so much, Gary. Two very interesting points. Can I just get your response to that first one, the idea of prefab housing? Mm-hmm. That's talking about not necessarily the permitting process, right? But like actually building the house. Are there things we can do to improve that?
Oh, yeah, totally. I mean, what we're seeing is a lot of innovation now in the construction process. And I think that's a real important piece of the puzzle here, right? Is to think creatively about how we construct. prefab housing, right? The idea of manufactured housing these days is actually, there's a lot of very high quality manufactured housing, which essentially helps then drive down the cost of the unit itself, right? So I think there are real opportunities to embrace new construction technologies. And so it'll be really interesting to see in the years to come how the city actually works to actually to do that.
As we get ready to wrap up, I got to ask you this. I love asking people, if you were in charge and you could do whatever you want. And you said the city needed 65,000 housing units to be able to fill the need. What would be the things that you would do to get that 65,000 units as soon as possible?
You know, I love this question. And the challenging part about all of the answers to this always with housing is that you want to say, like, there's one thing, there's this like silver bullet. And it's actually a myriad of things, which then everyone falls asleep and you kind of lose the compelling argument when you say that. But I think there's a reality here, right, that there are opportunities to really leverage resources that the city have, right? Vacant land that we could develop on, right? The idea of free land drive is really an important kind of element to be able to leverage. There's an opportunity, and the city's leaning into this to acknowledge that they create financing programs that are actually low to no risk for the city that actually lead to kind of large-scale housing production, particularly for low-cost units. You know, the city developed a really innovative rental assistance program called PHL Housing Plus, which gave direct-to-tenant assistance. And programs like that present real opportunities to address immediate kind of income needs and housing needs for individuals. So all to say is I think there's a lot that can be done on the land side, on the development side, but also on the subsidizing actual rental costs and a homeownership cost side.
Land, you got to throw a lot of perfectly spaghetti at the wall, it sounds like. see what sticks. But thanks so much for your time, Vincent Raina, professor and faculty director of the Housing Initiative at the University of Pennsylvania. Really, just wonderful in breaking some really complex stuff down. Appreciate your time today on Studio 2.
Really appreciate you having me. Take care now.
Yeah, and some good ideas from our callers as well. So thanks for calling in, and thanks for the comments. And thanks to our producers, Debbie Builder, Paige Murray Bessler, and Andreas Copes. Thanks to Mike Schiffler, our visual producer, and Al Banks and Tina Calique, who engineered today's show. Our executive producer is Kevin McCory. From Studio 2 here at WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Cherry Gregg.
And I'm flowing like water into Thursday's show. I'm Avi Wolfman-Aaron. Thanks for joining us. Took a sip of water. That was good timing.
That wasn't Schuylkill Reserve, though. That was not Schuylkill Reserve.
That was Ode Garbage. We'll talk to you tomorrow on Studio 2.